From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. America lights a beacon welcoming the world and noisily announces travel bans and construction of a wall at its border. America inspires and confounds, a land of melting pots and simmering resentments. Now comes a new series on Apple TV Plus that treats the varied experience of immigrants to this country with texture, with empathy, respect, poignance, and a generous serving of humor. This hour, On Point, the big ambitions of Apple's Little America. With us from NPR West in Culver City, California, is Kumail Nanjiani. He's executive producer of Little America. The Pakistani-American actor, comedian, writer, and producer is known for his role in HBO's Silicon Valley. With his wife, Emily Gordon, Nanjiani co-wrote and starred in 2017's Oscar-nominated semi-autobiographical romantic comedy, The Big Sick. And she's a co-creator and executive producer of this series as well. Kumail Nanjiani, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
This is, I got to say, this is a tremendous series. I thought it was really quite powerful. This was not, and we'll talk a little bit about its genesis later on in the show, but this was not originally your concept, your idea. What appealed to you about doing this after doing The Big Sick?
Well, you know, you hear a lot of sort of TV ideas and everything sort of takes a long time to explain. And, you know, I don't want to judge how good an idea is by how long or short it, you know, takes to explain. But this idea was an anthology show based on true stories of immigrants. It just immediately made so much sense as a TV show.
So what is the Los Angeles equivalent of New York's elevator pitch? Like, you know, elevator's not as big a thing in L.A. What is the equivalent out there? What would you call it?
I guess it's sort of the
Uber wait
standing in line at a coffee shop pitch.
Uh-huh.
Although that's longer than an elevator.
Yeah, you got about 45 seconds or so, depending on the coffee
still
shop.
Still to go? Okay, then I'm going into specific
there
episodes.
You go. So in this particular thing, what is it, before we get to the series itself, what is it do you find not depicted about the immigrant experience, about immigrant lives in television, in the movies, in what we have tended to see?
I feel like no matter what side of the immigration debate you're on, and I don't know if you're aware, but it is a hot topic right now.
Not heard
whatever
about
side,
it.
Okay. Just Google immigrant and see what the autocompletes say.
Sure.
That'll give you a good overview. I feel like no matter what side of the immigrant debate you're on, right, if you hear the word immigrant because of the way that they're depicted in American pop culture, the image that people get in their head is pretty similar. And a lot of it is sort of defined by defined by struggle and strife, not saying that those stories aren't valid, and we have seen those stories. We just wanted to tell sort of a different point of view, you know? I mean, these people are just normal people living their lives, and in some ways they're just, you know, not in some ways, in many, many ways, very, very similar to just people who are born in America trying to live their lives. So we wanted to sort of explore a different version of the immigrant than the one that you generally see depicted in American pop culture.
So let me play a clip from one of the episodes, which was particularly charming. Igwe is a Nigerian college student at the University of Oklahoma who finds a sense of belonging through the state's cowboy culture. Here he turns an exercise in a class aimed at helping immigrants integrate in the American culture kind of into a stand-up routine.
Hamburgers, cheeseburgers, bacon cheeseburgers, chili cheeseburgers, bacon chili cheeseburgers. Why? Why do this? Have other food on your plate if you must. Have your bread, your tomato, but why? Wet lettuce, why put cheese? Then bacon, a pig too? This stacking everything on top of everything.
The role of Igwe is played by Confidence. Kumail Nanjiani, tell us a little bit about Igwe, the character, the person, and what appealed to you about this story.
So he's a guy, he's from Nigeria, he comes here and he's sort of trying to find a place in America. He goes to school, and as you could see in that's sort of the first moment we see him sort of coming into his own. His family back in Nigeria is having a hard time, and the plan was always that he's going to come to America, study, and then head back. But because of circumstances, he's not able to go back. So he now has to figure out who he is, what his identity is in this new land, you know. And that's something that I really relate with because I'm Pakistani, came to America. And there's no real prescribed identity for me anymore, just as there isn't for Iwai anymore. And you sort of have to Voltron, like, different versions of where you're from into one sort of thing that's ultimately very unique to you. And that's sort of what the story is about. So the stakes of the story are, for overall, very small, but for him, very big. He has to sort of figure out who he is in this strange new world.
You said, I just want to unpack one thing you just said. You said that there's no one identity for you anymore, just as there's not one for him. What do you mean by that?
I mean, you know, so I'm not Pakistani because I don't live in Pakistan. And
sure.
I don't think people in Pakistan would accept me as Pakistani anymore. And I also think I don't feel American, even though this is my home, because I think so much of your membership in a group is based on the other members seeing you as a member of that group. And certainly a big part of the group of Americans do not see me as a member of the American group. So I sort of feel I'm in this middle area.
Do you think that's because you were born in Karachi? Do you think that's because you have an accent that they may not share? How you present and how you look to them at first blush? What would you attribute that?
I think all of that, a combination of all of those things. And I think it's become a little more stark recently. But it, you know, I never really felt fully accepted in America in that way. I think of late, the definition of American for a lot of people has gotten really, really narrow. And I certainly do not fit that definition or description. So, I think a lot of people do not see me as American. It's because of how I look, because of how I sound, because of where I'm from, because of what I believe. And so you're sort of forced to make your own identity. And it's something that I'm still working on. I do not have this figured out. Mm-hmm. You know, finding parts of where I'm from and parts of where I am and figuring out which of those I can use to sort of forge an identity. You know, my wife a little while ago asked me, she was like, "Do you feel American?" And I was like, "No." And she was like, "So then what are you?" And the only group I truly felt like I belonged in was comedians. So that was the only response I had. And I think that's still true. That's the only group where I really can be like, all right, I know for sure I'm a comedian. Nothing else I know.
A group in which one finds community, also a group, you know, which in some ways defines itself as being outside the mainstream because it's critiquing and satirizing it as it goes along.
It's just a bunch of broken toys holding each other.
That's another way of looking at it. I wanted to point out to listeners, we'd love to hear from immigrants and the children of immigrants this hour. For those who have seen Little America, what strikes a chord in you? What aspects of everyday life in the U.S. for immigrants do perhaps the political food fights and the news media overlook? Come on, Nanjiani, you had said earlier that, you know, this was not a political show or not an overtly political show. And yet you talk about this narrowing of the sense of what it is to be American, which is an interesting tension given that America itself, of course, is becoming more diverse. It is becoming less reflexively, less default white in terms of the makeup of its population than ever. And people, you know, more languages being spoken than ever in New York and in Los Angeles, but also in cities and regions across the country.
Yeah. I mean, I think some of that narrowing of definition by certain groups is a direct reaction to the diversification of America.
And yet, so why was it important to you that the series not be political?
Because I feel if you're telling a story, if you're telling stories of immigrants and you're making them political, then you're really taking the focus away from the people, away from their stories. We didn't want these people to be defined by their relationship to America, because then that becomes about America more than it becomes about these people. And again, those stories are very valid, but we have heard a lot of those stories, you know. We really wanted to sort of tell stories of immigrants that, I don't want to use the phrase humanize, I really kind of hate it. However, because I don't think humans should need to be humanized. Mm-hmm. However, I felt that if we did tell these stories, the types of stories where immigrants are not defined by their relationship to the immigration system or by their relationship to the American political system, then I think we would sort of expand, hopefully, people's view of what an immigrant is. Ideally, the goal is when someone hears the word immigrant, they don't get an image in their head because it's such a varied group of people and experiences that there's really no way to narrow it down to one image.
And despite all that you've said, there's a cheer and a sense of optimism and aspiration, but also just of hope, of the idea that some things are crushing and yet there's a belief in there's got to be a path to something that's fulfilling. There's got to be a path to me, as you put it, to figuring out who I am, even in this different land where I am not only experiencing stuff that's foreign to me, but I am myself perceived as apart and away from.
Yeah, I still feel – I consider myself generally a pretty optimistic person, pretty hopeful. Obviously, some of that has been challenged of late. I still have hope, though. I mean, you know, I went from Pakistan to a tiny town in the middle of Iowa. And obviously, all kinds of people are everywhere. My experience in Iowa was, by and large, wonderful. You know, now people sort of in their heads have like, oh, it's Iowa. There'll be a certain reaction to a brown kid from Pakistan. However, obviously, I did have some negative experiences, but by and large, everybody was very curious, was very welcoming, was very very warm, very nice. They wanted to tell me about America. They wanted to hear about Pakistan. And I think that that curiosity and empathy still exists.
You're hearing there from Kumail Nanjiani. We're discussing his new show, Little America, a series from Apple TV Plus about real-life stories of immigrants in the U.S. We'll talk more about the making of the program after the break. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing Little America. It's a new series available on Apple TV Plus, and it details the often unnoticed and very human experiences of immigrant life in the United States. With me is Kumail Nanjiani. He's executive producer of Little America. Kumail, one of the things that strikes you about the show, or struck me about the show anyway, in watching them, you have this beautiful visual palette sort of introducing the credits using slices of Americana, you know, the signs over a diner or, you know, a real estate sign or the like, very opportunistically taking advantage of it. And that stays visually the same each week. The music underneath doesn't. And it seems to me to reflect sort of the culture and music of the homelands. And one of the things that's striking is that the names of the directors and the actors change very much. And it struck me, it's hardly an original thought, but it struck me that you really worked hard to make sure people had often some sort of affiliation with the cultures they were depicting. Confidence is himself Nigerian, right? And he depicted somebody coming here from that country. You had this one story about a woman who came I want to get it right. I think it's from China, but wherever she came from, she was working essentially in a boiler room, pushing certain kinds of herbal remedies or whatever by the phone to, you know, credulous buyers. And she wins in a raffle a cruise that she takes her kids on. And her son is particularly, you know, he's an adolescent. He's trying to find his own way. And he's particularly truculent. And then at the end, you realize that the episode has been directed in real life by the son of that woman. It was a very powerful moment.
Yeah, so the writer and director of that episode is Zee Chun, and he that's based on the story of his mom. And Josh Behrman, who you'll be speaking to later, was just having a meeting with Zee to perhaps direct an episode, and then Zee started talking about his experience with his mother and sort of growing up in this, you know, going on this cruise ship, how they used to always, they would always go and try and win vacations, and they actually won a bunch of vacations. And this one particular cruise ship where the mom was sort of trying to hold on to the kids while the kids are becoming people on their own. And Josh immediately was like, oh, this is a fantastic story for Little America. So, you know, there are these stories sort of everywhere. We just have to be able to find them. And what a lovely thing that he told a story about himself from the perspective of his mother.
Yeah, and that he was able to capture what she was going through in terms of his actions toward her and his clearer identity, you know, to be fair, as clearly a guy who saw himself as an American kid, right?
Yes, he saw himself as an American kid and also definitely as a teenager who wanted to hang out with other teenagers. And, you know, I find this happens a lot with immigrants, the actual people who move there, sort of the tension between, excuse me, the people who move here versus the kids who grow up here. You know, the parents who actually move here themselves make a tremendous sacrifice. They give up their lives. They come here a lot of times. They have to work a lot harder in jobs that pay a lot less than they were making back home. And you envision a certain type of life for your kid. And then the kids, since they've grown up in America, are choosing the people that they want to be. And a lot of times that doesn't line up with the person that your parents wanted you to be. And so it's this weird, I don't know if catch-22 is the right word, but they sacrifice their entire lives to make a specific life for their kids, and then the kids choose something very different from what the parents had envisioned. So, and that's certainly something that I've experienced myself too.
It's a tension that exists there that is the aspiration for people to have free will and the desire for them to choose as you would set it out for them.
Right, exactly. It's like, I want you to have free will, but choose exactly what I want.
Choose from this menu of one choice.
Right.
Kumail, I want to take advantage of this. People are calling in. They're interested in talking to you directly. I'll take a couple calls. First one from Baltimore, Maryland. Praneet, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. The conversation is very interesting to me, and I just wanted to give my comments and share a piece of what I feel about being an immigrant here. Just a quick background on me. I came here when I was 21 years old, just by myself to study after my bachelor's, and I'm 37 now, and I'm still working towards my green card because I'm from India and there is a big wait line. But my comment is that as an immigrant, I have felt part of American community, and I feel like a member here. And there are times when I don't feel like that, but the thing is, I think that occurs wherever you are. Like if an American is in India for a long time, there might be times when you don't feel part of it because of so many other factors. Because, you know, my family is in India, and but the thing is, I am building my life here. I have two daughters, 7 and 5, And if I am, if I'm not able to accept that fact, I'm not sure how my kids will take it. Like if I don't feel part of the community, and even with the times that I really cannot feel it, how would my kids who look at me and see how I'm part of this community take it? So that's my comment.
Thanks for that comment and that question, Praneet. Appreciate your sharing it. What do you hear when you hear that, Kumail?
Well, what I hear is a little bit of tension, too, you know, where he said sometimes he feels part of America and sometimes he doesn't. But it seems he's saying that because his kids are growing up here, he really, really wants to feel like he's part of America, right? And I don't know, ignore the times when he doesn't feel like he's part of America. And that's a very, very relatable thing, you know.
It captures a little bit. There was an episode that focuses on a couple who had immigrated from Iran, and the father embarks on, shall we say, a quixotic quest that we can leave to discovery by viewers. But one of the tensions underlying is his pride in his son, and again, the desire to keep him close and to keep him in the rhythms and the traditions of where he was, even as the son, again, is trying to blossom in this country that he knows. He thinks of himself as Iranian-American, but American fundamentally. I want to take a call now from Mechanicsville, Virginia. Brian, thanks for listening. Thanks for sharing your thoughts today.
Hi. How are you? I saw an interview about the show about the immigrants in America, and we're looking, my wife and I and children are looking forward to seeing it. I came here in 1969 from Trinidad, West Indies. And I went through a shock, you know, and the shock was while I was in school, the African-American kids didn't welcome us, and we always had trouble with them. And I took the time out to ask this kid, why do you want to fight us and why you don't like us, you know? And he said, well, look at you, you know. He said, you're not like us. And I said, what do you mean? I said, my skin is the same color as yours. And he said, no. Listen to how you sound. Look at your hair. Your hair is not like mine. Your skin is not like mine. And it kind of blew my mind. It really blew my mind. And you know, my parents had struggles as well because they always thought that, and even told us, you know, our parents are here to take their jobs away. And that's one thing we heard a lot. Now, my kids today are American citizens, but they don't see themselves as American citizens, and a lot of my nieces and nephews also. I think they've more identified with our culture.
And Brian, would you say that they think of themselves as Trinidadian Americans? Would you say that they think of themselves as Americans who happen to be from Trinidad, or in a sense, cultural Trinidadians who happen to live in this country? Like, where do they locate themselves?
Yeah, they locate themselves as being American. However, their culture and background and the root of who they are, they more go towards the Trinidadian culture, West Indian culture.
And that's interesting. I'm sorry, Brian. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it seems your children have forged or are working on forging an identity that includes both parts, right? So the American, where they're born and raised, and
Yes, they are. They are. But they try to cling to the good parts about America, and the negative parts they go away from. They won't embrace the negative parts, you know.
I got to say, that sounds pretty good to me as a dad. I would be in favor of that as a formula for us all, and for us all to remember, you know, where we come from, whether we've arrived recently or family has been here for many generations. Brian, thank you for calling us today and sharing your family's experience.
I thought that was a very interesting story, because I know a lot of people from Pakistan who immigrated themselves, and then I also know a lot of people from Pakistan whose parents immigrated here. And to me, in my very small sample size of people that I know, the relationship that people have to Pakistan is so different generationally, where it feels like for the kids who grew up here, they're able to pick and choose the parts of Pakistani culture that they want and not the parts that they don't want, and then the parts of American culture that they want and not the parts that they don't want. Whereas the people who moved here from Pakistan themselves, in some ways, don't really have that choice. You don't really get to sort of pick and choose what of Pakistan you want to keep and what of Pakistan you don't want to keep.
I want to take one caller now, Omar, who I believe has a question for you. Omar is calling from Boston. Thanks for waiting, Omar.
Hi, Omar here. I'm actually fascinated by the discussion with Kumail and also the callers. I myself, I'm an immigrant. I came here from Lebanon after having a pit stop in France. I did my graduate student school in France and also in Minnesota, Midwest, like Kumail, but a little bit larger city. And of course, I've been employed in corporate American companies, and I'm executive right now in clinical research. And what drives me is I don't wake up in the morning and say, "Hey, I'm an immigrant. How can I deal with the rest of the world?" I wake up as myself with a full baggage that I accumulated over the years and over my travel around the world. And the main challenge that I have is I'm always making fun of by my kids. and a good way. Hey, you're fresh off the boat, and they're fascinated by my story because I was a refugee at 1 year old during the Lebanese War, and I take that as a strength, as a superpower. And I never had any issues in America in terms of like racism, discrimination, all that. I always fit. I always deal with it in a positive manner. However, one of my kids, the older one, he was called a terrorist by his peer in Texas when we lived for a while in Texas. And that was kind of a decision-making point for us to leave Texas and come to Boston. Not to say that this kind of comment doesn't exist, although my son is, I'm on the tan side, not the brown side, but my son looks totally white. He fits in any crowd of American kids. He can't tell except by his name. That he's got something exotic to him. And that was like a shocking piece to us because the kid who called him terrorist fourth grade, he's a Chinese himself. So he's an immigrant too. So that's kind of a piece of story that really fascinated me. But what kind of identity, Kumail, you think your kids will pick if you're not Pakistani, you're not American fully on each side? What do you think your kids will be identifying as, and how do you deal with it?
Kumail Nanjiani, what do you say to that, to Omar's question?
Well, I want to say I don't have kids. However, I think about this. I think about how different I would be if I was a brown kid growing up in America versus being a brown kid growing up in Pakistan. I think it's a complicated question, and there's no real answer to it. I think I just have to trust that my kids would find a version of themselves that sort of brings them happiness and satisfaction. And I'm 41 years old, and I still haven't figured it out. So I don't know how long it would take my kids to figure it out.
Well, let's go to one of the episodes in which, in a sense, they address that. Marisol is a high school student from Mexico. She doesn't have legal status to be in this country, and her life is turned upside down by an urban squash coach's program. He's offering free shoes. He's offering lessons on how to play the game. But she has to take the lessons if she wants the free shoes. Here's what he tells Marisol after her very first lesson.
Good, very good.
Really?
No, you were bad. But inside of you, there is a jaguar.
Okay.
In the words of the great basketball player, Kevin Garnett, a.k.a. KG, you cannot teach the beast. It is either in you or it is not. You cannot go to the store and buy a six-pack of Beast.
John Ortiz plays the coach Fabiano, who warns against trying to buy a six-pack of Beast. Jernes Corchado plays Marisol. Kumail Nanjiani, tell us about this girl and her sort of changing thinking about what role she can play in American society.
So she is, as you said, an undocumented immigrant. Her mom is an undocumented immigrant. They clean houses. And she's just a young lady who's actually not that different from someone who was born and raised in America. She's a little disaffected. She's a little apathetic. She's a little rebellious. She doesn't know who she is. And I feel like in American culture, sometimes you can sort of find something that you're good at or passionate about, and then try and form an identity around that. Try and figure out who you are, how you can contribute based on that. So it's this girl who's sort of disengaged from everything and then figures out that she really likes squash and really can be very, very good at squash. And so that sort of gives her a sense of purpose and a sense of belonging in this country. And she goes on to, the real person that the story is based on goes on to real success as a squash player and becomes a sort of an internationally ranked squash player.
This is an extraordinary story. One of the interesting twists in that story or elements of that story is that the mother isn't hostile to this, but the mother can't be there like every suburban mom. She has to clean houses. She has to be there. It is a big sacrifice for her to support her. And even so, she kind of gets it. She says this is somebody thriving and prospering in American society.
Yeah, and I really like the family unit in that her, her brother, and her mom, their relationship is I just think it's really beautiful in that it's supportive, but it's also, it's complicated. The mom gets upset at her. I just haven't seen, generally you would think in a sports movie, someone's doing that to prove to their parents that they can do it. Here, it's pretty supportive, and the challenges are sort of more from within for her.
We're talking with Kumail Nanjiani. He's executive producer of the new show Little America on Apple TV+. After the break, we'll be joined by Joshua Bierman, co-founder of Epic Magazine, where some of these stories were first published. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're discussing Little America, new show from Apple TV Plus that captures vignettes from the immigrant experience in the United States. With me is Kumail Nanjiani. He's the comedian, actor, and one of the lead executive producers of Little America. Also joining us from NPR West and Culver City now is Joshua Bierman. He's a journalist and co-founder of Epic Magazine, the original source for the stories told in Little America. He's also an executive producer of Little America. Josh Bierman, welcome to On Point.
Hi.
So Thanks for having me. You bet. Happy to do it. As I said to Kumail, it's an incredibly moving and impressive project, I got to say.
Oh, thanks so much. I appreciate
each
it.
Each in their own way. Josh, talk to us a little bit about the origin of this. This is one of those that it turned out, I was surprised to learn, my producer cued me into this, was in a sense a little bit backwards engineered. That is, it didn't go straight from the magazine to the screen. There was some thought ahead of time about this.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I'm a journalist and I also work in film and TV because a lot of my stories get adapted and I work on the adaptations, and normally that's how it goes. But every so often a writer or producer will come to me or us with my company now that sort of works on this type of thing with an idea that they think might be really enlivened by a true story. And that's what happened here. Lee Eisenberg, who's a pretty well-known, you know, writer and showrunner and also somebody that both Kumail and I know. He just called, and his dad's an immigrant, and so he said this was right around the election, and I feel like the reality was sort of setting in. It was right around the inauguration, actually, and he called and he said, you know, I've been thinking about doing a show about immigrants, and I feel like it would be great to figure out a way if there's some true stories to help shape that idea. So I said, sure, let's think about trying to collect a lot of stories and see what that tells us, what kind of stories we can tell, what kind of show we could potentially make. And then very quickly we talked to Kumail and Emily and also Alan Yang, another writer and director.
From Master of None.
From Master of None, exactly. Mm-hmm. Some of the episodes of Master of None were sort of inspiration also for this type of show.
So?
Because they deal with there's an episode in the first season that's about the parents and sort of the relationship of immigrants and their parents and their differing relationships to, you know, being in the country. And there's an episode in season two called New York, I Love You that's sort of like a series of small vignettes that are just kind of incidental stories of people that are usually maybe in the background of another episode. And it chooses mm-hmm. to follow them. And that's kind of the idea that we had here. These are stories about people who normally would be, you know, somebody that you would see in passing in an episode of TV, and this is actually going to be their story. So we have, we're kind of thinking about all that. And obviously even Big Sick, similarly, is a rom-com, but one of the protagonists happens to be an immigrant. And it's that's, you know, sort of at some conceptual level, very similar, because we just wanted to tell stories that were about people's lives, but they happen to be immigrants. And so we kind of all started talking, and then the stories were coming in, and we started looking at these stories. We had like 150 leads probably when we started. I have a bunch of researchers on staff and also a lot of, you know, friends in journalism publishing. So we had freelancers working. We canvassed far and wide and brought all these stories together. And then we started looking at them as a group, and it was sort of very clear right away. The stories were so interesting, compelling, and all different kinds. And it was just very clear that there was a great show here. And this, and sort of the format of the show like almost emerged just out of the stories.
You were the author of a Wired article in 2007 that was made in the movie Argo about basically taking care of hostages and in Iran, if I recall correctly, made in the Ben Affleck made the movie. How do you make sure to do justice? Obviously, you have to tweak things for narrative purposes, but how do you make sure to do justice to these, given that these are true life tales?
Well, it's interesting. It's something you sort of deal with in adaptation all the time. And I have always found, actually, I mean, I didn't really know this going into sort of dealing with film and TV, that especially the kind of stories that I wind up doing, and certainly in the case of Little America, that often when you're adapting, the best kind of creative strategy is to stay as close to the real story as possible, because the stories often turn on authenticity, right? Like in Argo, that's such a ridiculous story that if it had to seem real, or else it would have seemed fake. Like if you wrote it as a fictional thing, you'd be like, nah, that's
there we go, so, folks.
But because it feels real, you can sort of buy into the story. And so it was actually very and then also all the trappings of it were made to feel very authentic. So you could feel it's not like a James Bond movie. It's like a close to the bone real spy movie. And so some of that lesson was learned here also. I mean, we all kind of felt this. We wanted to tell stories that were authentic because that allowed you to connect with the characters and, you know, see them sort of just, especially a show like this where it's like these kind of vignettes, like you have to like immediately connect with characters that feel like real people because you only have half an hour to tell a certain amount of story. And so we really tried to honor that in this process. Even like in the writer's room, we would go back to the subjects many, many, many times over because people would be sitting around trying to think of like, well, how do we tell a story about this Nigerian student who becomes a cowboy, and the writer's room would be sort of fishing around trying to figure out what might happen in like a episode of TV. And we would say, no, well, what happened in his real life? We just go back and talk to him at length. And in fact, like that, his little speech you played about the hamburgers, that came verbatim from him. I mean, he told us that story. And in some way, when he told us that story, it unlocked something about his character, because we realized it, so he sort of came to life in a certain way and realized like, oh, this is a story that he tells about being comfortable with himself in America because he's making fun of the local food, right? He's not feeling out of place. He can feel like he has a sense of place to sort of make a comment about the place that he's living in. And so that's why we put that in the episode. And it also comes at the moment where he feels most comfortable with himself, right? So it gets at this emotional truth.
He's wearing the cowboy hat directly from his life. The kerchief,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
By that point.
Yeah, he's wearing his cowboy hat. He's kind of had his stride down the street. He's kind of felt like embracing this American mythological iconic kind of self, you know, gave him a sense of place. And so, and that's where he kind of reveals the speech. And it's very emotionally true. And so that's what we tried to do with all of these stories, was try to get as much of that as possible and make it feel very real.
Kumail Nanjiani, you know, you've done stand-up. I've seen a bit of stand-up you've done in the past. I thought it was a pretty good bit. I thought, it, you know, he was doing this in what, the early 80s? It seemed to me like it was not that different from what Seinfeld was doing in the early 90s.
I know he should have followed his muse, and he would have been
another
Johnny
broken
Carson.
Toy.
I remember specifically thinking when I first came to America, I was like, they really like mixing their meats here. And for me, it was very like, chicken is chicken, beef is beef, they should never meet on a plate. And then here, it's just like all different animals on one plate. And then, you know, I've been here for a long time, so I sort of had forgotten that observation. And then in listening to this gentleman talk about it, I was like, oh, yeah, that's exactly what I thought, too. Too much stuff on a burger.
He also had this other funny idea, which we edited the speech a little bit, but he was talking about pizza. Same thing. He's like, oh, hamburgers, I don't get it. You stack everything. And then he's like, pizza, half an idea. Don't understand it.
To figure what that means, because it seems like a pretty complete idea, but maybe he wants a calzone.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, there's another one of your episodes actually has a character who pretty clearly disdains pizza too, right? Like, she hates it. Beatrice is a Ugandan immigrant. She's a daughter of bakers there. She fulfills her family's dream of moving to America for greater opportunities, loses her job as a waitress, and out of desperation seeks to sell homemade cookies on the street. It's a flop until she starts to carry the cookies in a basket on top of her head, which sort of evoked the way things were done in her native land. And then there's a scene where she encounters a car of teenage boys who are both intrigued and probably highly stoned.
Cookies!
Hey. I dig your outfit. Those colors.
Why is that on your head?
I'm selling some cookies. 50 cents for one, but for you, my friend, I'll give you two for $1.
Hell yeah, we'll take like a lot.
Like a dozen, I'll give you a discount.
We totally need it, does
it? Oh, yes, yes, yes. And 12. Go, get the money.
How's that stain on your head right now?
African magic.
Beatrice is played by, and I'll try to pronounce her name correctly, Kemiyondo Coutinho, I believe. And yeah. The real-life Beatrice you show is portrayed in a huge poster as sort of among a series of major local entrepreneurs at her local airport. And you realize she hates pizza because she borrows a friend's pizza joint to cook the cookies initially late at night, and she just can't eat anything that they're offering her. Tell us a little bit about Beatrice and her story, Josh Behrman, and why she was one of the ones that you picked.
Sure. So that's all. But obviously, if she's a real person, that's all true. Even all those details that she had to go cook her baker cookies in a friend's pizza oven, all that stuff comes out of her real life. And we thought this was interesting, partly because in real life, she is actually a very sort of a homegrown hero. Actually, a friend of mine is from Louisville. When I told her we were going to do a story about Elizabeth is her real name. We changed all the names for the show. My friend was like, oh, yeah, the cookie lady. I've had those my entire life. My mother sends them here to me. You know, like she is really, you know, kind of a local fixture. And so we just thought that was interesting. As we were trying to develop the show, we wanted to have a real range of experience. Part of the idea is that it's sort of a faceted portrait of immigrants, right? And they're all different. Every story is different. That's also sort of part of the whole idea. And so we wanted people who are here for all different reasons. Some are young, some are old, people in different parts of the country, people from different parts of the world, people here as refugees, people here studying. And so Elizabeth sort of represented an interesting niche because she came here as a student and she wanted to go sort of one way in life. And then things didn't quite work out exactly as she had planned. I mean, that's also another feature of people's experience as immigrants, right? That's not every story is like the immigrant pluck allows them to overcome all the obstacles and they succeed in their dreams. And so this story was things kind of took a left turn. And then there's kind of this interesting irony that she became – her success was found in her baking of this also quintessentially American thing, which in fact, it's sort of there's a funny kind of relationship with the Ikwe story where he doesn't understand the American food, the hamburgers, the classic American thing. And Elizabeth actually makes her whole career out of baking chocolate chip cookies, which, by the way, don't really exist. Like in Uganda, there aren't really sweets like that. And so it was just a weird kind of accident that her father had been a baker and had once, and, you know, had sort of introduced her to chocolate chip cookies, but most people in Uganda wouldn't know those at all. And so then when she comes here and that becomes her path forward, we just thought that was a really interesting kind of a twist on the story.
Well, a couple of these stories are sort of about people figuring out their place in America by figuring out what they excel at or what they want to do, right? So the story with Marisol and the story with Beatrice are sort of similar in that way, in that they both sort of find their place in America by finding what they're going to do here.
One of the interesting elements of Beatrice's story, Kumail, is that actually her parents kind of want her to, or I guess her father has died by this point, but her mother and family really want her to come back. And there's a notion that this was their dream for her, but if she's not going to live it out the way that was envisioned, then the mission is done. And she needs to come home. And she clearly asserts that this new life is the one she wants to live.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, that's such, in some ways, to me, that's such an American story. You know, your parents want a certain life for you. You try to live that life. It doesn't happen. You're not doing well. And then you sort of figure out the life that you actually want to live, and you sort of find success through that. That's a very, very American story, I think. We've never seen it from the perspective of a Ugandan immigrant.
And Kumail, I want to play a clip from another episode, which is, I think, really the only episode where the action and the sequence predominantly takes place outside of the United States. It focuses on a man named Rafik. Rafik is gay. He is also Syrian. He flees from his hometown to Damascus, the capital, after his father burns his arm to warn him of the hellfire that awaits because of his sexual orientation. He makes a new friend in Damascus named Zane, more comfortable in his own homosexuality, who tries to comfort Rafik with the words and wisdom of the pop star Kelly Clarkson.
Her lyrics are so deep. She won American Idol. I'm sure you know her.
I don't think so.
I'll spread my wings and I'll learn how to fly. I'll do what it takes till I touch.
Shut the hell up. People can hear you.
Hey, chill. I was just messing around.
I don't want any trouble. Please, just leave me alone.
Kumail Nanjiani, it is not Rafik's family's dream for him to go to America at all, and yet he has to do it. Tell us about that decision.
Well, he sort of, you know, as you mentioned, he's gay, and so he has to find a place where he can be himself, proud and loud, and sort of the only place that he can, you know. Here's the other interesting thing that's about these stories, and you mentioned that way in the beginning of this hour, America sort of represents two different things to people around the world. It can sort of be this destructive controlling force, but it is also seen as a land of opportunity by a lot of people. And the stories, the characters in these stories sort of have, they're sort of in the spectrum there somewhere and how what America represents to them. And so to Rafik, America does represent this land of opportunity, this place where you can be what you want to be and be who you are and really express that and live your life authentically. Mm-hmm. The irony there is that the actor that you heard there singing, Adam, couldn't shoot in America because of the travel ban. So for that one episode, we had to move production to Montreal to be able to shoot a story about someone who is able to live their authentic life in America. We had to shoot that episode in Canada.
And that also, even though taking place in Canada, a truly American story. We've been hearing there from Kumail Nanjiani, Oscar-nominated writer and executive producer of Little America. Kumail, so great to have you with us today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. By the way, I really loved hearing from people's immigrant stories. I was very, very moved. That was beautiful.
It was terrific. It's part of the great part of the show here at On Point. We've also been hearing from Joshua Behrman. He's a journalist, co-founder of Epic Magazine, and another co-executive producer. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
You've been listening to On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. Thanks so much.